You're listening to Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Colin Wilson, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Okay, thank you very much.
Now, Colin, it's been over 50 years since you wrote The Outsider. Could you give us a breakdown of your career, how you came to write that book, and what's happened since?
Yeah, so The Outsider came out when I was 24 years old. That is in 1956. And I had been born in a little working-class town in England, Leicester, and my education was just ordinary, sort of secondary school education. I left school when I was 16 and went to work in a factory. But I always wanted to be a writer, and when I had to get married when I was 19, and that didn't last very long. But while I was living with my wife and son, I was doing my best to start a book about outsiders. This had been a subject that had always interested me. All of those people in the 19th century, all of those romantics who had such a high rate of suicide, that's what fascinated me so much. And they didn't really sort of want to live, in a sense. You know, Villiers de l'Isle Adam makes the hero of his play Axel say, "As for living, our servants can do that for us." So I understood all this very well. And finally, I started to write a novel called Ritual in the Dark, which I began to write in the British Museum back in 1954 or 55. And when I'd got about halfway through the book, the superintendent of the reading room, who was a novelist called Angus Wilson, said to me, "What was I doing?" So I explained I was writing a novel. And he, a very nice chap, said, "Well, let me have a look at it when you've got some of it, and I'll show it to my publisher." So I said, "Thanks." Anyway, just before Christmas, 1954, Angus went home for his Christmas holiday, and I knew that he would be going home, so I tried to get the first part of the novel finished by then. And I did finish it just before Christmas, and I gave Angus the typescript to take with him. Then, having nothing to do over the next few weeks, I didn't want to get writing again until I knew whether he liked the book, I decided to do a non-fiction book about what I called outsiders. And for me, an outsider was essentially an in-betweener. He was somebody who's intelligent enough to feel very dissatisfied with the kind of life that modern civilization offers to most people, but not necessarily brilliant enough to be able to, as it were, demand his own terms from society. In other words, a kind of in-betweener stuck in between two stools. And I felt that an enormous number of those writers and poets of the 19th century belonged in this category. Well, I began sketching out this book on Christmas Day, 1954, at my lodging in London. The girl, my wife now, and who was my girlfriend then, had gone home for Christmas, but I didn't have the money for the train fare. So I stayed on in London and sketched out this book, which I called The Outsider in Literature. Then I began to get quite a lot of ideas for the people who ought to be included in it. And as soon as the new year came and the British Museum opened once more, I went straight down to the museum. I cycled down there, and on my way there, I suddenly remembered a book that I'd read about years before in the introduction to a book called Under Fire, a novel about the First World War by a French writer, Henri Babus. This novel I'd read about and was called Hell, L'Enfer, and it was about a man who lived in a little boarding house in Paris. Then one day he discovers high up on the wall of his room a little hole, is one that's used for all kinds of guests who come and go. And he spends his day simply staring through this hole at the lives of the people in the next room and describing this. Well, this fascinated me because I thought, my God, what a symbol of the outsider looking through a hole in the wall at other people's lives. And so, when I got to the British Museum, I ordered L'Enfer by Henri Barbusse. I discovered it was translated into English. And I settled down and read this right through in one single day. And then towards about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when it was getting close to closing time in the museum, I wrote down a sentence from the book. The sentence that started, in the air on top of a tram, a girl is sitting. Her dress blows up slightly in the wind, and then goes on something like, it is not a woman I want, it is all women. Because I wanted to express this kind of sexual dilemma of the average young man in a modern society that seems to be full of, you know, delicious girls that he's not allowed to touch. And so, I wrote down this sentence, which later became the first sentence of the book. And then I began writing. Every day I went back to the museum and continued from there. After writing about Barbusse's L'Enfer, I went on to write about Sartre's first novel, a thing called Nausea. And then I went on to write about H.G. Wells and his short story, The Country of the Blind, in which the hero says, in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And says that, you know, the trouble with modern civilization is that, in a sense, we're all in the country of the blind. Anyway, I went on writing this book busily, and Angus, in the meantime, had finished my first part of Ritual in the Dark and liked it, and said, I'll offer this to my publisher when you've finished it. But I decided, as I was getting on so well with The Outsider, that I'd finish that first. Well, after about 3 months, that is to say, round about March 1955, Joy, that's my wife, and I went down for a day to Canterbury and just to sort of, you know, wander around the cathedral and play at tourists. And on the way there, we passed a second-hand bookshop, and outside in the rack of second-hand books, there was a book by a publisher called Victor Zolanx. And the book was called A Year of Grace, and it was a kind of anthology of, you know, poetry and mysticism and this kind of thing. Basically, I suppose, about religion. Now, this, in a way, was the basic subject of The Outsider. And so, I bought this book. It was only about sixpence. And later on, I decided to type the first part of The Outsider, its opening, and then a chapter after the middle of the book, and send it to Victor Zolanx. Well, I did this, and to my amazement, I got a letter back from Zolanx saying, this sounds a very interesting book. I'd like to see it when you finished it. Well, I worked on and on and on. Then my mother was suddenly very ill from peritonitis, and I had to spend a lot of time up in Leicester with her because she had to have operation after operation and very nearly died. And incidentally, I had a typical near-death experience. When she was quite close to death, she was convinced that she was dying, and then she suddenly found, she said, this old man was sitting at the side of her bed, dressed in a funny kind of white garment, looking like something out of the Old Testament, and he said to her, now look, you can't die yet, you've got far too much to do. And then she fell asleep and woke up feeling greatly comforted and was sure that everything was okay.
Wow, that's amazing. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Yeah. And so, of course, my mother did manage to live and see the publication of The Outsider, to my great delight, because, of course, it became a bestseller. Anyway, Zolanx told me to finish the book, and I sent him the first half of it when I went up to Leicester to see my mother in hospital. When I got back from Leicester, there was a letter from Zolanx saying, well, we'll definitely publish Fisher's book and offering me a small advance on it. Well, actually, I was kind of knocked out. It seemed absolutely wonderful. And the book was accepted by Golan. I was convinced that once he read the whole book, he'd say, oh, no, no, I don't want myself drawn. But in fact, he liked it. And it came out in the following year, in May of 1956. And of course, I woke up and had literally this experience that Lord Byron described as waking up to find myself famous. And the two leading serious Sunday papers in London, the Sunday Times and the Observer, both gave rave reviews and said, you know, what a brilliantly intelligent and well-written book it was and so on. And of course, it became an instant bestseller. It had actually been turned down by an American publisher, but an American publisher now very quickly snapped it up, and it also became a bestseller in America. And there was I, quite suddenly, finding myself famous at the age of 24, or just before I was 25. Now, it so happened that another young writer called John Osborne had written his first play, Look Back in Anger, and this went on at the Royal Court Theatre in London just about 2 weeks before The Outsider appeared, and was again a tremendous overnight success. Now, they hadn't had many writers in England since the war. Angus Wilson was one of the very few new writers, and of course he was middle-aged. And so, John Osborne and I tended to get linked together. And since John's first play was called Look Back in Anger, the critics weren't sure whether to call this new generation of young writers outsiders or angry young men. But they quickly found that angry young men had better publicity value. And so John and I got linked together as so-called angry young men. There were others. For example, a writer called John Brain wrote his first novel, Room at the Top. Alan Sillito did a novel called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, and so on. And so the result was that we two, John Osborne and myself, as angry young men, became famous. And so, this kind of thing sounds absolutely wonderful, but in point of fact, becoming famous overnight is not necessarily very good for you, because what it does is to arouse a terrific amount of jealousy. And I soon found, you know, that the critics who praised me originally, finding suddenly that I was being referred to all the time in the popular press, became very hostile. And within a matter of weeks, from being a sort of famous young writer, I was kind of infamous young writer. And I would say that within 6 months of the appearance of The Outsider, nobody had a single good word to say for me. The same, of course, applied to John Osborne. I mean, we were just too successful. Anyhow, throughout this time, Joy's parents turned up at my flat in London carrying a horsewhip and declaring that I was a homosexual and that I had 6 mistresses. So, apparently her sister had been reading my diary, and when I'd been staying with them one weekend, she got completely muddled up because it was my novel about Ritual in the Dark, the novel about a serial killer based on Jack the Ripper, she got in mind. And of course I'd mentioned the fact that, you know, a relative of mine was homosexual and various other things, and they'd given her some very peculiar ideas about me. So her parents turned up at my flat and tried literally to drag Joy out by her arms. Well, I called for the police, and they came along, and they said to Joy, how old are you? So she said, 22. And they said to the parents, well, in that case, we can't do anything. If she's 22, she's able to choose what she wants to do. And since you're in this gentleman's flat, you'll have to leave. Well, as soon as they left my flat, the doorbell rang, and it was a mob of reporters. The chap to whom we'd been giving dinner that evening was a sort of villainous old queer named Gerald Hamilton, who is actually in a novel by Christopher Isherwood called Mr. Norris Changes Trains. He's Mr. Norris. And the first thing Gerald had done when all this terrific uproar was going on was to rush out to the nearest phone and ring up Harper Fleet Street. decided that we would move elsewhere, the man in the next room said, well, I've got a cottage down in Cornwall, which we now at a very low rent. And so we took the cottage and we moved down to Cornwall. And of course, we've been here ever since. And I've gone on writing books.
Over 100 books now so far, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, I'm the kind of writer who enjoys ideas. And the result is that, you know, even if I didn't make any money from writing, I would go on writing because, you know, this is completely natural to me. But I have indeed done 20-odd novels and numerous books, generally speaking, following these kind of basic philosophical ideas of the outsider. You see, the outsider, I suppose you could say, was basically about existentialism. That is, about the philosophy of Sartre and Camus and so on that was so fashionable in Paris at this time. I always disliked this philosophy intensely because it was so basically pessimistic. You know, Sartre says, man is a useless passion, and so on. And I hated this, having always been a sort of rather cheerful and optimistic sort of person. And I have always believed that if you can simply look at things quite objectively and consider the kind of things that made Sartre and Camus think that life is meaningless, you end up by feeling quite cheerful about things. The result is that I've produced what I suppose is a different kind of existentialism, a kind of new existentialism. And this, I would say, has been my life's work. Of course, when I was, it must have been about 10 years after this, I got a letter from my agent in America asking me if I would write a book about the occult. And it was a subject that always interested me. And a big American publisher, Random House, wanted to commission it. And I said, okay. So, I went to Mallorca at the time I started the occult, met the poet and novelist Robert Graves there, got to know him quite well. I found him sort of quite charming, very, very interesting. And I said to Robert, someone's asked me to write a book about the occult. What do you advise? And Robert said, don't. Well, it's a good thing I ignored him, because when the book did appear, it became another bestseller. And of course, the subject has always fascinated me anyway, the paranormal. And it didn't take very long to convince me that the paranormal was completely genuine, but it wasn't the kind of illusion as I thought to begin with. And of course, this has become one of the things that has interested me deeply ever since. And of course, I remembered my mother's peculiar experience with this old guy when she was on the point of death. And it's become one of the many things that I've written about a great deal since then.
Fascinating stuff as well. Now, we're at the 20-minute mark. And I just had, you know, we could go on forever. You've written so many fascinating things. I have quick questions that people have sent me in to ask you. Number one, you wrote a book about Aleister Crowley called The Nature of the Beast. And is it true that Crowley was instrumental in founding the Wicca movement, the contemporary witchcraft movement?
Yes. It was actually a guy called Gerald Gardner who launched all of this, but Crowley certainly was very interested in the paranormal and the occult, and also in becoming a magician. He really believed that magic works, which it does indeed. And so I wrote this book. I should say that Crowley is the only person about whom I've written a book whom I would not have wanted to meet. He seems to have been an extremely nasty man.
Oh, yeah, horribly so. But he was somewhat involved in forming some of the Gnostic mass, and some of these, like Gardner's rituals, look very similar.
I suppose so. And he did, of course, form sort of various groups. And one of them was called the OTO, which was based on a German group. And, of course, Crowley moved away to Italy and there founded his own sort of island in which he taught this kind of thing. He got thrown out of Italy when an enormous scandal occurred.
That's when there might have been a human sacrifice and Mussolini threw him out of Italy.
No, there wasn't a human sacrifice. What actually happened was that one of his disciples died under rather peculiar circumstances after being forced by Crowley to drink the blood of a cat.
So and, it was strange, whatever it was, if it wasn't deliberate. It was certainly a strange death.
Yes, and Crowley was certainly largely responsible for it. But of course, the kind of thing that came out later, there was a court case about it to the effect that, you know, Crowley had all kinds of pretty garish sexual practices, and they led him to be labeled the wickedest man in the world, which he didn't mind in the least. He loved publicity.
Oh, right. It's just why we're on Crowley. Something came out last year that showed that George W. Bush's grandmother, Pauline Pierce, was a disciple of Aleister Crowley. Did you see or hear anything about that?
No, that's a wonderful idea.
No, it's definitely, I'll send you a link to it. His grandmother, Barbara Bush's mother, was with Crowley in Paris in the 1920s. And, and I had confirmed this. And when she came back, Barbara Pierce Bush, the president's mother, was born 9 months later. So there's a lot of rumors that Barbara Bush, George Bush 1's wife, is the illegitimate daughter of Aleister Crowley. And take a look on the internet; they look a lot alike. You'd need a DNA test. But that's the new thing on Crowley over on this side of the pond, is the Bush Crowley connection, which may or may not be true, but it's interesting to think of.
Marvelous, yes. Crowley made a point of seducing absolutely every one of his female disciples, unless they were downright horrible and ugly. So I have no doubt whatever that he would have slept with her.
Well, that's pretty much what Brad Steiger said as well. If she had spent 3 months with Crowley, Crowley wouldn't tolerate a woman for 3 months unless he was having sex with her. I don't think you tolerate one for 5 minutes. One other question, just the subject hop again, which I love to do. I was talking to Robert Bavall the other day, who's writing a new book now called Black Genesis, claiming that the world's oldest civilization might be in southern Egypt. And that's kind of a debate. What is the oldest civilization on Earth? And people have different opinions. What is your opinion? What do you think the oldest civilization on Earth is?
The oldest civilization is quite undoubtedly the culture of the Neanderthals, which was around for a quarter of a million years before we came along. And they seem to have been highly intelligent. They had a bigger brain than we had. And all of the evidence seems to show that they had a genuine culture. I've written various things about it.
Yeah, you wrote a book about this, Atlantis and the Neanderthal. Yeah.
That's right, yes. Yep, and I put all of the basic facts in there.
So your argument would be this proto-Neanderthal culture would be the oldest civilization on Earth.
Yes, yes, but, undoubtedly. Although, you know, there's so much weird stuff that has come up. Signs of ancient civilization, like a block of coal that was found with a shoe print inside it. And yet the coal was undoubtedly dated back to the Carboniferous era millions and millions of years ago.
Oh yeah, it's hard to pin down which one, but it's quite interesting because people are taking different sides on it. You know, some say it's Mohenjo-Daro in India, some say it's Mesoamerica, some say it's Egypt, now you're saying it's Neanderthal. People, for some reason, are theorizing about this now, and I was just curious where you came down on. And there's a lot more of it, there's a lot more books out there than you might realize about this. It's quite amazing. I'm trying to keep like a bird's eye view of them, but it's quite fascinating. I don't want to hold you up any longer. We've gone about a half hour. Is there any particular book you have out now that you'd like to give a plug for?
Yeah. I've just finished writing a book about Shakespeare, which sounds a dull kind of subject, except that what I'm arguing in this book is that Shakespeare managed to get syphilis from this Mr. W.H., to whom he dedicated the sonnet. And not that Shakespeare was homosexual, he wasn't. But he was associated with a young homosexual called William Hatliff. And William Hatliff became a kind of King of the May in London at the same time that Shakespeare was a young playwright, persuaded Shakespeare to become his secretary, more or less, and tried to persuade Shakespeare to go to bed with him. Well, Shakespeare didn't want to do this, wasn't interested in it, but Shakespeare did fall heavily in love with a dark lady called Luce Morgan. And Luce, in fact, was in love with Hatliff. So Hatliff saw his opportunity and said to Shakespeare, look, I tell you what, if you go to bed with me, I'll persuade Luce to go to bed with you. Which is what happened. And so, whether it was three in a bed, six, I don't know. The only thing that's certain is that poor old Shakespeare woke up 2 or 3 weeks later to find he got the first signs of gonorrhea. And of course, in due course, it killed him.
Oh, wow, that's quite amazing. And is this book print yet, or are you working on it now?
I finished the book about a month ago, and at the moment I'm just sort of doing some revision.
Oh, so it'll be coming out pretty soon. Do you have a provisional title for it?
The title of the book is Will Shakespeare's Hand, and I don't yet have an American publisher. I have an English publisher who's very interested.
Oh, right. Well, people will be able to get it over the internet anyway, even if it's in the UK. And we'll keep an eye out for it. What's it called again? Could you tell us the title?
Will Shakespeare's Hand.
Will Shakespeare's Hand, and that's by Colin Wilson.
And a writer called Donald Hobson, whose uncle, Leslie Hobson, was a very famous Shakespeare scholar.
Oh, you have a co-author on this?
I have a co-author on it, yes.
Oh, very good, just to make that clear. Well, Colin, thank you so much for coming on Sphinx Radio. We'll have you on again.
Thank you.